Committee on International Relations and Cooperation. Let me take the opportunity to welcome the honorable members of the committee and to wish them very well that we will have a robust debate, but as the committee name suggests, as the face on a number of issues to the outside world, we will cooperate. Honorable Olomisa agrees that we will cooperate. But let me also welcome the excellencies who are here, because I know that this is a matter of interest to a number of countries as to where we're going in terms of our policies on international relations and cooperation and what our program is. So you are welcome. The members of staff from the department are also welcome, led by the DG to this particular committee. Of course, whilst there are the members of the executive, the minister, the deputy minister, two of them, they are members of this particular committee. From time to time we'll call them, and they must be here. That's why I'm putting them at the end. Whilst they are setting up, I want us to look into our agenda, adopt the agenda. I have this proposal. The first would be the introduction. Second would be the register and apologies. And third will be the presentation of the strat plan, of course, in preparation for the budget vote, which will be led by the minister. That's the main item. And lastly, the item I hate most, any other business, because it becomes free for all. And then people raise the issues which they were supposed to raise in the agenda. That's the proposed agenda for today. And remember, we have 2 hours for this meeting, so it's no more 2 hours, but we can stretch people beyond 12 o'clock, if necessary. Let me just repeat. Introductions, apologies, registering apologies, presentation of the strat plan, and any other business. That's our agenda. Any other items agreed, seeing that there's no opposition, then we move. Can we go into the introduction? We have the out request, the members of the committee, starting with Honorable Olomisa, to introduce themselves, but let's just record that from the executive we do have the Minister of the IRC with us. We do have the Deputy Minister. 2 Deputy Ministers are also with us. Can we start, Honorable Olomisa?
Chairperson, Andrew Olomisa from UTM.
Can chair from ATP?
Ben Kosana from the IFP.
Digun Malama, ANC. Tisa Tomakama, ANC.
Okay.
Elizabeth Philisa Mswane, ANC.
Sivan Mukhalapa, DA. Kenneth Lebo, DA.
Gerard Koornhof, ANC.
Ruth Mahau, ANC.
Thank you. Thank you for that. We know that there are people who are not members of the committee nor the staff members from the department, but as interest groups, you are welcome as observers to this particular process. And as a newcomer in Parliament, I've been told that whenever there are issues which would need us to be in committee, we will inform you on time, as per the rules, that we might not open, but there are procedures to follow that. So for now, as observers, indeed, you are welcome. We will circulate the register. Bulelwa Botoman is the committee secretary next to me. She will circulate the register, and so that everybody fills it and signs it. As a teacher, that's the most important thing to me, the register first, before I start teaching. So that's very important, because you might say you were absent when you were not absent. But if you have not filled in the register, any apologies? I've received one apology. You see, the great threat now has made me to lose my judgment when we're checking from the other office. I have one apology. Is there any other apologies? I am told, and I think we must agree, that like all the other organizations, that apologies, since this is our first meeting, must be written to the secretary of the committee. If they are verbal, we will note those apologies. But I'm also told that SMS can be official writing. There was a court case involving the issue of an SMS. Whether is it official, it is. And CIR getting up as workers when we deal with some of the issues defending the workers, that SMS is authentic. The apology which we have received is from Honorable F. Machibela, who would be joining this meeting later. That's the only apology. Thank you. Yes, Honorable Kusang.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to say that I will leave before 11. I've been summoned to the Speaker's office at 11. So I'll leave perhaps 5 to 11.
Thank you. Knowing your responsibilities or your other responsibilities in the House, we won't object to that. We'll accept that apology. Seeing that they... Yes, Minister.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I also appeal that I be released at 11, as there are some urgent matters that we need to discuss with the Executive Secretary of SADC, as they are facing political issues in the region. Thanks.
Secondly, Honorable Minister, we will accept because of those other responsibilities. Seeing that there is no other apology, we'll step off from this item and accept these apologies presented to us and move straight into the main agenda item. This is how we have to handle this item. We will allow the minister to open on this particular item, then followed by the DG, who is going to give the details of the step plan. And then after that, we can raise questions of clarification. And if there will be some questions, because if people are seeing the spread plan for the first time, they might also want to go and study it, sleep over it, but of course they will raise preliminary questions now. I think it would be allowed that they go and prepare those questions, they can send them to the department, then they will be responded to later on. But that's the approach which I'm proposing. Any different opinion on this approach? Thank you. Can we allow Honorable Minister Maite to lead us?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. We want to actually, as we salute the members here, appeal that the acronym for this department be DICO, D-I-C-O. Honorable members, officials led by the Director General, Dr. Nsaluba, members of the Diplomatic Corps, Your Excellencies, Ambassadors and High Commissioners present here, interest groups who are our partners in building a coherent international relations and cooperation policy. The ruling party, as we move into this new mandate, in this new 5-year term, has given us the privilege to lead this department. It's my honor and a privilege to work with the esteemed members of the committee. And let me, on the outset, commit myself and our two deputy ministers, our first deputy minister, Ibrahim, and our second deputy minister, Honorable Susan Renerve, that we shall, at all times, be accountable to this committee, listen to the word of advice and contributions of the committee, as we together and working together, building a coherent international relations policy. I'm sure we've all noted the change of name to International Relations and Cooperation. A friend of mine jokingly said that we needed to change the name because we are just not about external affairs, but we are about building relations and relations that must last, underpinned by our interests, our national interests, but also knowing that South Africa is not floating, is not a floating island, but it's very much an integral part of Africa. Therefore, our main focus would be SADC, Africa, and the world, as we work for a better Africa and a better world. Change of name was necessitated by the fact of the matter that the world expects a lot from us, and that our responsibility is not just building the relations, but also enhancing our capacity to work in cooperation with our partners, but also enhancing our international cooperation. South Africa has been engaged in a lot of cooperative programs, starting with some financial assistance that we give to the countries in need, particularly in Africa, similar to the line of order, but overseas development assistance. But we've moved far beyond that. We've been involved in conflict, in peacemaking and conflict resolution and post-conflict rebuilding of countries. I'm sure as the DG outlines the work that we plan to do and what we've been doing in the past, you will see the scope that I'm referring to as far as assistance matters are concerned. So hence the change of name, integrating international cooperation. We shall, during the course of the year, outline our plan to establish a full-fledged South African Partnership Development Agency, as informed by the resolutions of the ruling party conferences, but also the consensus that has been reached by all interested bodies in this sector. The mandate we have as a department goes back to the expectations of the Constitution of South Africa. That says that the President of the Republic is ultimately responsible for foreign policy and international relations of South Africa, and that the department is entrusted with the formulation and promotion and execution of South African foreign policy, with the daily conduct of its international relations and cooperation. This mandate also is influenced by a number of key global principles, which are: South Africa stands for and propagate multilateralism to secure a rule-based international system, peaceful settlements of disputes, a contribution to the formulation of international law and enhancing respect for provision thereof, strengthening bilateral relations with both countries in the continent, South-South relations and North-South, because we believe that we still stand a very good chance of continuing to be the bridge builder between North and South. But with the economic global meltdown, we believe that our future and how we get out of this crisis would also be informed on how we strengthen relations with the countries of the South, because we believe they offer us great opportunities for markets for our products, but also opportunities for investments for us to be able to respond to the call of the 10 key priority areas that have been outlined by our president. Chair, due to time constraints, I would want to hold my enthusiasm in laying the groundwork for the DG to make the presentation on our strat plan for this incoming year, financial year. Safe to say that one of the main challenges that the department is facing in the wake of this international financial environment is that we will have severe cuts and constraints, financial constraints, as we try and endeavor to do our work globally. The DG, I'm sure, in his presentation will tell you that when we got the budget we got last year, for example, the exchange rate was fixed at 7.50. And those who know mathematics better than me know that we were short of almost 2 rand per dollar right from the outset, because the rand-dollar exchange has been hovering at around 9 rand throughout the financial year. So these are some of the constraints that we have, that while we have to all have to strive to strike the rand, we also are impacted upon negatively by the foreign exchange challenges. I would pause here, Chair, and thank you ever so much for giving me this opportunity.
Thanks, Honorable Minister. Now we will give over to the DG. What I also have to check with the support staff, if all the members have the necessary documentation. I suspect that we're supposed to have the strat plan. So I have to check and ensure that all the members have that. But whilst that is being organized, we will allow the DG to lead us. Over to you, DG.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Madam Minister, Deputy Ministers, and honorable members of the committee, excellencies and colleagues. Chairperson, what I will try to do is we circulated also a PowerPoint presentation which tries to perhaps be more detailed than the presentation that we'll make because of the time. But I will try to run through I'll try to run through that, and in each of the slides probably lift up the issues that I think merit perhaps a bit of emphasis, and of course just indicate that all that I will be saying will also be contained more in the detail in the strat plan document. So we've also tried to follow exactly the sequence of the strat plan. The first slide really just gives an indication of some of the principles that underpin South Africa's international relations policy: promotion of human rights, democracy. Ministers also raise the issues of international legality, promotion of peace, and so on. The important thing that we'd like to make really relevant to this slide is just to say, as you disaggregate, as you lift up this issue, you will see close correlation between the issues that underpin our international relations framework and the fundamental underpinnings of our constitution, thereby showing the strong connection between what guides us in our international work and really what we pursue in our domestic policy. This slide just indicates the broad areas, and the Minister has already indicated, highlighted some of these, that basically our work, one, the anchor, as the President indicated in the State of the Nation, is really the consolidation of the African agenda. That remains central. Then there's the issue of South-South, North-South cooperation. Minister has alluded to some of the issues related to our participation in the international system of global governance, as well as in strengthening of political and economic relations. But of course, for purposes of the START plan, that's more the political agenda that we pursue. That has to be backed up by some work in the START plan that has to be related particularly to organizational strengthening, organizational support services, and also professional services that the department offers. So those are the broad areas that really relate to our work. With respect to the consolidation of the African agenda, we basically anchor our work on four key issues. The first one is to participate and help strengthen the regional organizations, and these would be the AU and SADC in particular. But increasingly, there's a tripartite that's emerging of SADC, COMESA, and the East African Community, and that's an area of focus for us. The second one is to make sure that we contribute to the implementation of Africa Socioeconomic Program, which is NEPAD, as well as its regional counterpart, in essence, which is the RSDP for SADC. Then the Minister alluded to our work on the area of peace, security, and stability, and increasingly shifting to both conflict and stabilization and reconstruction. And of course, we want to strengthen bilateral political and socio-economic relations with countries of the continent. Now, the issue around the African unity and integration, we really see political and economic integration of Africa to be a key area of focus for our work. Now, we also adopt an approach to African economic integration that is underpinned by strong regional economic communities. And increasingly, you know that South Africa has been participating in the work related to the diaspora, and we want to continue that work because we think it does offer opportunities for the continent. There are a number of partnerships that Africa has with the EU, the Africa-EU partnership, with the China, the FOCAC, with Japan, TICAD, with countries in Asia, NASP, and also with Africa and Latin America, and there will be a summit coming on in Venezuela this year. So we participate in all this, and we regard this as an important work for us to strengthen the African continent. With respect to peace and security, there are a few things we will do. The first one, at a continental level, I think we'll continue the work that we've been doing to make sure that the African standby force becomes a reality. And I think with respect to the region and the SADC Brigade, I think there's been exemplary progress, and our defense force has been key to that. Also, the establishment of the Early Warning Center, and again, South Africa is actively participating in that. There are areas that we want to continue with peace building and reconstruction. The Great Lakes region, we are encouraged by the progress that is registered there. We need to finish the work in Cote d'Ivoire. There's the work in Zimbabwe that the President referred to in the State of the Nation, and we'll come back to that, and also in the Sudan. Again, I think there is work that we started during our short tenure as non-permanent members of the Security Council, which really related to strengthening the partnership between the AU Peace and Security Council and the UN Security Council. And this to make sure that as Africa plays a greater role in, for example, peacekeeping missions in the African continent, we work in partnership with the UN so that we can leverage the resources that are there. Now, on South-South relations, and again here, there are very important movements historically that we've participated in even before the democratic dispensation, which remain very important movements for us to align ourselves with, and the non-aligned movement, the Group of 77 and China. Then there are newer ones, the Itza, the Nast, as I've indicated to, the Indian Ocean Rim, and the and Foltak. All those are key formations of the South that South Africa will continue to participate in. And in the detailed threat plan, we more or less give an indication of what are the points of emphasis in each of those formations. Then, of course, there are North-South relations the Minister has referred to, and here we want to list out in particular that the work that we need to continue to complete on the making sure that the Doha Round is a developmental content. Increasingly, South Africa has got what is called an enhanced engagement with the OECD. We want to participate in that. And then, of course, there is the issue of the G8. More importantly for South Africa's relations, and I've jumped to one or two slides, is really the work that we're doing with the European Union. And again, just bearing in mind this is our largest trading partner, so in our North-South interaction, this remains key. And at the heart of what we're trying to do with the EU is to ensure the full implementation of the Trade Development Cooperation Agreement, TDCA, that we signed with them. We have, of course, over the past 2 years, registered some significant progress and elevated our relationship with the EU as that of a strategic partner. The implication of that is that we now meet the EU at summit level. The first summit was in France last year, and we will have the honor this year to host the EU at summit level for the first time on the 11th of September here in South Africa. Now, with respect to the issues of global governance, again, here South Africa will play a key role in the promotion of development, of security and human rights, and will participate in all international fora to essentially advance these key major areas of importance to us. Now, we, of course, the Minister indicated the issue of our belief on the peaceful resolution of conflicts, and particularly ensuring that whatever we do in the resolution of conflicts or in all our work is underpinned by international legality, so full respect of the UN Charter and the underlying principles of international law. Now, I've already mentioned the issue of the engagement with the Security Council. And we also say as the last bullet that there are many initiatives that currently are taking place with a view to strengthening really multilateralism far much more fundamentally. And we'll participate in all of those because we believe that a strong multilateral system anchored around the United Nations still provides the basis for really international cooperation. Now, there are some specific areas around the issues of United Nations reform. This is something that's progressing at the pace of the tortoise. But we are hopeful that over the next 3-5 years, perhaps some breakthrough of some form will come out, and South Africa will play a key role in that. There are also issues that are related to the political reform, which are really the reform of the way the UN system functions, that is the Secretariat, and the broader its management. That is something that we'll focus on. The Minister is keen that we try to deal with the issue and address during these coming years the issue really of South Africa's participation, South Africans participating really in the multilateral organization. And here we are raising this in relation to the to the UN, but it's a far much broader issue. And in all our international engagement in the UN, I think the last bullet there is that we'll really be focusing on the issues of African development. The last bullet on this slide, which is like to focus, is that sometime back, about 2 years ago, the Swanda South African government, we went with the UN Evaluation Group. We decided to engage the UN to start a process of evaluating the partnership between the UN and South Africa. Now, South Africa poses a bit of a dilemma for the UN because we are not a traditional developing country. And so we have been anxious that the way that the UN engages us must reflect the sort of ambitions and also the reality of South Africa so that this becomes a true partnership. So we started this process of evaluation. There will be a report that will be presented to the Minister in the coming month or two. And then coming from the recommendations of that report, I think will spell out far much more clearly the way South Africa will interface with the UN system. One of the major areas of interaction in the global system is, of course, the work that we're doing in the G20. bearing in mind that so far we're the only African country that participates in this. Minister alluded to the current reality of the international economic crisis, and of course the G20 is at the front, at the spearhead of trying to deal with this issue, so we'll participate in that. But just to say that the underlying principle that will guide us in the work of the G20 is really to make sure that as the developed countries in particular address their problems, they do not close the policy space for us as developing countries to address our own problems too. So that is at the heart of the engagement that we have. Then there's the issue around the issue of climate change, which we will be participating in. There will be a series of activity culminating in Copenhagen in 2009, December, but the work thereafter. And of course, there's the issue of the many resolutions that have been taken, particularly in the area of social development. Now, the area about strengthening of bilateral relations, we've already said that Africa is at the heart of this. We will be particularly paying attention to strengthening the relations with countries in SADC. I think our accumulated experience as a country is that when we are stronger in SADC and when SADC is coherent, then we've got better possibilities to advance the African agenda. So there will be quite a lot of focus on this. And of course, there are instruments, the Presidential Economic Commission, the Financial Commission, that will be looking at, and particularly focusing on some of the countries that require assistance now so that they can play their full role. One such country, of course, is Zimbabwe, and of course, what we've included here, the President alluded to in the State of the Nation. And a partnership that we want to elevate and look at in the coming few years is that with Angola, because we believe it holds promise for both our own interests. There are presidential economic commissions that will continue to consolidate, and we've had positive experiences with those, Namibia, Tanzania, and Mozambique. And also in those with Botswana, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe, also with what the joint commissions on defense. Now, we will also be looking very closely at the issue, and the minister will be participating in the next few weeks in a meeting, looking at the future of Sudan. We've got certain concerns about that, particularly the implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. There are some worrying signals. And of course, you know that if this is not implemented properly, and if the South then opts to secede, and the chances are great that they may, then of course the entire configuration of Africa might be under threat. So this is a major issue. South Africa will participate in that. And of course, we've got a problem closer and nearer home within our father's family in Madagascar. And I think our own assessment is that it will require both a short-term intervention, but in the next few years, a far much more stronger intervention to make sure that we establish durable peace in Madagascar. Now, in the Asia and the Middle East, we will be focusing particularly in the area of economic diplomacy with respect to the People's Republic of China, there's the Republic of Korea, there's the issue of Japan, and with Japan we'll also celebrate the centenary of official relations this year, and just to say we're also preparing to participate in the Shanghai Expo in 2010. So here the main drift, we've got good political relations with all these countries, what we want to explore and develop further, and there's a good basis for that, is really economic relations. And in South Asia, Southeast Asia, and Australasia, with respect to India, there is work again on the economic side. We've got solid political relations, but I think both of us agree that we can do more on the economic side. And what we'll be looking at is a South-India preferential trade agreement to complete that. But we also are nudging further to establish a broader relationship with the countries of ASEAN through ASEAN as the association of those states. In the Middle East, now, we always argue that the Middle East is very important for us because it's a significant source of our energy requirements. We have got a good presence in the Middle East, including in the Gulf states. So we have a keen interest in the stable peace in that particular area. With respect specifically, so we'll focus on the issues of the Israeli-Palestinian issue, the issues of Iran, just to make sure that there's peace and stability there. But more importantly, with respect to the Gulf states, we have taken a conscious decision that These are net importers of non-oil goods generally, and we believe the scope for South African exports to get into that market. But also we see this country, in spite of it being hit like any other part of the globe by the financial crisis, but we still believe that there's a lot of liquidity in the Gulf that could be leveraged for purposes of foreign direct investment in our continent. So we'll pay a lot of attention to that. And of course we've got a lot of JDCs which are functioning well with the countries in the Gulf, and we'll continue with that. Now in the Levant, as I say, that we will be focusing largely to the Israeli-Arab conflict and also try to support the restoration of democratic peace in Iraq. Now, the Americas, both North and South, and in making a general statement first, we have strong bilateral relations. Maybe I should just move straight first, and I'm going to go to the slide on North America, sorry, honorable members, just to make one point. And this is to stress the point that U.S. is one of those countries that we have strong political bilateral relations. Secondly, it's very important for us to leverage for purposes of advancing our African agenda. But thirdly, that there has been some opportunities for us which have related to the AGOA, which actually has led to a situation where, with such an important country, that we've got a far much more balanced trade pattern, and we need to preserve and build on that. Now, the slide before that was the slide looking at what we'll be doing in Latin America and the Caribbean, and just to say again, this is where a lot of the African diaspora is, so we want to strengthen bilateral as well as strongly people-to-people relations with Latin America and the Caribbean. Then there's the issue of the SARCO-Mercosur PTA that we need to complete and expand. And of course, we think that there's tremendous scope, again, for economic relations with these countries that still need to be developed. And of course, here, we're in the process of consolidating some of the instruments for financial cooperation like the JDC. I'm sorry, I'll then move on to Europe. In Eastern Europe, again, we are trying to consolidate our presence in Eastern Europe. This is an area which is well endowed with strategic minerals of strategic importance to us, and so we want to consolidate on that. In Central Europe, a number of the countries in Central Europe have actually joined the EU as the new accession countries, your Poland, your Hungary, your Romania, and so on. Now, one of the things we've been trying to do is now to strengthen our bilateral relations with them, so that they do not become an obstacle as we further consolidate our relations, particularly with the EU. So we will continue down that path. In Western Europe, of course, Western Europe, that is where most of the countries that are influential, either in the G8 or some of them are members of the P5, and these are a huge economy. So it's important for us to strengthen our bilateral relations with them, both to advance our national interests, but I think it is fair to say when we interact with most of these countries, we also focus a lot on advancing the broader African agenda. Now, both the Western Europe and the U.S., I should have mentioned that, continue to hold on in spite of the current crisis in terms of the number of tourists visiting South Africa. And of course, it's a major growth and job creation area for us, so we want to focus on that in the coming years. Now, one of the things that we will be focusing on is in the plan of the department, is also in the plan of the international relations cluster, and that is the issue of the establishment of the South African Development Partnership Agency. I think what we will be trying to do here is to give some greater focus to South Africa's development cooperation, particularly with the continent. Now, we've made a commitment to the executive that sometime in November, we will present to the cabinet a document that will, first of all, outline the policy brief and hear the anxieties to make sure that as we develop our instrument for development cooperation, that it is actually underpinned by the principles of development and partnership. Secondly, we will have to interact with the committee because there may be legislative implications for the establishment of this agency. And thirdly, of course, will be the issue of the criteria for the disbursement of funds and really what are the areas that we'll be focusing on. And so this will be a very important instrument, really, in our efforts to consolidate our international relations work. That broadly, members, that would be then the political agenda that we're trying to focus on. Now, I will come to some of the supporting services. Now, I will skip the slide. We've outlined the slide, and this diagram is in the stress plan. It basically gives us the theoretical framework, really, of how we're approaching the issue of human capital development in the department. The same with the second line, basically to look at the key elements that we're looking at. First of all, positioning of our department, making sure that we attract the right talent, the issue of performance management, the issue of training, and the person, of course, of retaining people who are in the organization. We're giving you a sense of really the status of where the department is. So the department is still in a growth phase. I think there's a general acceptance that for the mandate that we have, we still need to grow. Minister has alluded to some of the challenges that we're facing, particularly in the current financial year, which constrains the prospects for growth. So I think this financial year, what we are focusing on is a bit of just consolidation and make sure that we don't lose ground because of the financial pressures. But again, the details of the slides are there. And here we try to give you, on the basis of the equity targets that are set by government, a breakdown of the membership of the department. Now, there are certain things that we are trying to focus on. One, to improve gender representativity. You would have seen in the slides that we are, if you look at women in senior management, we are at about 34%. Of course, there is a target of 50% that we have to work towards. But what we are trying to do is to do a bit of focus when we are focused on our recruitment in order to attract women into the organization. But just to say some of the principles that we are following here, interacting with women's organizations and so on, are also the same principles that we are following to deal with the issue of people with disabilities. Because again, that's an issue that we are struggling with to meet the 2% equity targets that have been set up. And again, we'll not focus a lot on this field, but basically, this just shows some of the work that we've been doing in the HR over the past few years and some of the challenges that we're trying to focus on. And just to say right at the end, one of the things that we have done now is to look at organizational culture and climate survey, which has given us a sense of some of the weaknesses in the organization, which obviously sets the agenda for the work that needs to be done in the years ahead. And again, this is a slide that is in the strat plan, and it basically takes on the basis of these key four areas what it is that we'll be trying to do under each. So I will not go into detail on that. Now, there are some challenges that we face on the human resources side, and this is the issue, as I said, of the gender and disability targets, maintaining and sustaining momentum for culture change in the organization. So the issue of talent management, how we retain talent within the organization and make sure that the organization has got a common understanding of that. Then there's the issue that we, like all other departments of state, trying to focus on the issue of performance management and really addressing poor performance, regular processes of people feedback. And then in the case of our department, there's an important area which is around employee wellness. I think sometimes we underestimate the impact on families of the movement sometimes into new territories and then people come back into the country. So we've been growing that portfolio. And then, of course, issue of management of discipline in the workplace. Now, from the human resource perspective, there are certain challenges that are specific to this particular period that we'll have to focus on. The first one is that the minister has challenged us to look at the organizational design in line with the new mandate and the new elements in the mandate of the department. So we will have to spend a bit of time looking at that and suggesting an appropriate structure. This may also be related, for example, to the issues in the presidency. There's a national planning unit, there's a monitoring and evaluation, and whether, in fact, in the department, a counterpart organization that relates to that would not be necessary. So those are the sort of things that we'd have to look at. Of course, we've spoken about the issue of SATPA, what is going to be the relationship between this new agency and the department. So all those discussions will take place in the next few months. Then, of course, there's the issue of building up the capacity of the department and continue to position the department in the market for purposes of attracting people to the department. Then there is an area, the next area that I will run fast through, with the area really related to our training academy. The first slide I won't spend too much time on. The second slide also, I will just highlight the fact that the focus on the, that's the third bullet, on the training content within our diplomatic academy, particularly as there's been increasing drift towards economic diplomacy. But more importantly, we've introduced programs that have SADC and which are SADC and AU-wide programs. And we believe that our own diplomats can benefit a lot through constant interaction with their counterparts from the region. What we've also done is to make sure that the qualifications that are provided by our training academy for our diplomats are now accredited through the SAQA framework. We also have started, we have supported before, a cadet program which is progressing well. But last year we also started a master's program in diplomacy, and that program, we are in the process of evaluating it with a view to proceeding with it. Now there are some special programs that we've run. For example, on negotiations, the issue of peace, the issue of women in diplomacy. And one of the problems we've been trying to grapple with is the fact that there's been a complaint in the department that we might have some reasonably good programs for capacity building in head office, but when people are placed abroad, those programs do not continue. And hence we've continued the process of e-learning. And again, this is an area that we'll focus on in the years to come. I'll skip this one also. I think this slide speaks to the second priority, speaks to some of the issues that I've already discussed. Now, one of the units that we have is our research unit, PROW. This is an area that we'll be focusing on in the years to come. I think it is not as strong as we would like to be, and we would be the first ones to consider. And then that indicates that this is our vision of PROW, and over the next 3 years, this is what we want to do with PROW, so that it really becomes a strategic center for the evolution of new ideas related to our foreign policy. So it's going to be a major area of focus for us. Another area that we are focusing a lot on, and the good work that has been done, is on the area of foreign languages, to equip our diplomats, but also to assist other state departments. We also are helping a number of institutions in South Africa. For example, our airlines, some of the major companies that have got far much more of a global footprint in the area of protocol training. We've got a program that that we're excited about, which we've just started probably about in the second year, but it holds a lot of promise for us, which is called Ambassadors in Residence. And basically, this is a way of us to capture some of the knowledge and experience that has been captured by people who have served South Africa for a long period of time. And when they come back, we put them in our research and our training center. First of all, to mentor new, the young diplomats, but far much more importantly, to also begin to record some of the experiences that they've had, especially those areas where we've had significant involvement. For example, now we have people who are recording our detailed experience in the interaction of Rwanda, what Rwanda has gone through, what are the lessons for South Africa, what was South Africa's support to Rwanda, the same with Burundi. So that over time we can make sure that as we intervene in other areas, we have this board of experience that is documented, and also the key lessons for South Africa moving forward. As I say, this is far much more to institutionalize memory. I think I've spoken to this slide. One of the areas that is an important area increasingly for us is the provision of consular services, and I'm now moving to our corporate services. And consular services is that, remember that we've got an obligation to make sure that we look after South African citizens abroad. There may be people, for example, who are in prisons abroad, but we have to provide them with consular services. There may be individuals who are caught up in some of the disasters, like, for example, was the case in the case of the tsunami. And it may also be individuals who are caught up in conflict situations and therefore our mission to have the responsibility to interact, try to connect them to their next of kin. So it's a very important area, and with the income mobility of South Africa, we're increasingly finding that this is an area that we need to develop. This is also an area that is used to help South Africans authenticate documents. If they happen to be abroad and need to engage in transactions, then our consular services are in a position to help that. One of the initiatives that we've tried now is to put on what we call ROSA, registration of South African abroad, basically which we have been promoting to the market, to make sure that South Africans get into the habit of getting into our website, register themselves when they are taking trips abroad, knowing that we protect the confidentiality of that. It just helps us when there is a disaster to be able to have a credible database that tells us who is where. We found that, for example, during the tsunami, that people's movement were not known sometimes to their relatives, and later on would think that somebody might have said they're going to London, extended that trip to some other place, and then it just enables us to help the relatives there far much more faster. There is an issue, of course, of rapid response team that we are working on with other arms of government. This slide I will skip, it speaks to the same issue. So that's an area that we are focusing on. Now, then in the area of communications and technology, there's a program that we started and was previously reported to Parliament previously, which is really an upgrade of our IT system to do a number of things. First of all, just to help us communicate with our missions better, but also from a business process management point of view, it enables us, for example, to have online interaction, for example, on the consular management, the point I was just indicating now. Generally, the issue of registration of diplomats in South Africa for purposes of us administering the Immunities and Privileges Act, and also help other business units basically in the work that they are doing. So that process is going on. Now, on the security side, again, a part of corporate services, this is an area for our department which is important, particularly security of documents is an important issue. So we continue to tighten up the work on that, and again, in the years to come, we'll continue to improve on what we are doing with respect to meeting the requirements of minimum information security. And the key area that we are looking at also is the vetting of all departmental officials. Now, honorable members, in the stress plan document, we are supposed to give you an asset management plan, which we have done. But there are a few things that we want just to indicate. One of the initiatives in compliance with the PFMA we've been asked to do in the past few years is really to establish a credible asset register for every government of state. Just to say we're dealing with that, and I think so far we've done good work on that, and we're continuing to improve improve on that. We have a bit of a complication on our side because we are operating essentially in 124 missions in 107 countries. So to record every asset that we have, small and big, obviously is a very laborious process. So we have an agreement with the Treasurer and Auditor General's office on a three-year plan to do that. But what we've done now is to prioritize the high-value items, and that process has been done. For example, land and buildings, motor vehicles, paintings, sculptures, and so on, and that work has been completed. Now, as I said, we've got also this, a lot of properties in these many countries where we are. In the recent past, we decided as a result of the increase in our property portfolio to establish two separate units, one dealing with properties and facilities and one on the supply chain, one at the level of chief director. One of the pressures, Chair, that I think will keep on coming to this committee for is that because we are having these many, many places where we have our missions, and most of the time we are renting properties, and it's costing us a lot. And so we have started a process that has been agreed on with Treasurer of beginning to move towards property acquisition. We'd really like to get the support of this committee to advance that work. Now, we've suffered some setbacks in the current period. There's been a slowdown in that process. But I think it's something as the economic state for the country allows for us to continue to do that. I think it's a more cost-effective way in the long term for us to provide our services. Just to say also, as you know, we previously indicated that we are currently operating in 7 buildings in Pretoria, and we have started the process of acquiring a consolidated headquarters through a public-private partnership process. That process has now been finalized, and I think by the 26th of June this year, we will all have moved to the new building, which I think will be a significant landmark in the history of our department. I've already hinted a bit about some of the key issues around the issue of asset management. Just to say that obviously we've taken a clear strategy to prioritize where we can have properties, because we can't do everything, and we took a decision that we'll prioritize the countries, the P5, the G8, where there are multinational organizations, SADC countries, and all our strategic partners. Basically, these would be countries that we know that we are going to be in those countries for a very long time, many more years to come, and therefore it makes sense for us to purchase. I've just indicated here that the details are in those pages that are indicated in our threat plan. Now, coming to the issue of the budget, Chair, this first slide just gives you an indication of the allocation to the department starting 2006, 7, 7, 8, and 8, 9. Just to say that up to the end of the last financial year, you can see a consistent pattern of high spending from the department. And maybe let me stress also, this is high spending going together with unqualified audits. So this is money appropriately spent. And maybe that also to say that in the 08-09 year particularly, we're particularly proud because we're not only unqualified, but we truly had a clean audit. And we're one of very few state departments to achieve that. Now, this is the MTF allocation moving forward. This is what we bought, $5.3 billion for 2009 and 2010. Now, Chair, we are in serious trouble, I must say. We are in serious trouble this year. We will be in serious trouble next year. We will be in serious trouble in the year thereafter. So we will be coming to the committee to say, probably, to give you a detailed presentation of some of the pressures that we really feel. The minister spoke to one of the fundamental pressures. And this has to do with our budget is very sensitive to currency fluctuations, because close to 60% of our budget is spent abroad. Normally we have an agreement with the Treasury that during the adjustment estimate in October, they review and then either they say we return money or they give us money. Like all Treasuries, they are good at asking us to return money, and sometimes not too good to offset the cost when we are the ones that are hit. And so that has happened in 08-09, and we can see it coming in 09-10. So really this is a major problem. The consequence of this is that it has significantly limited our operational budget. And we run the risk, if we are not careful, of having officials that were in missions abroad constrained in doing work because of just not having very basic budgetary allocation. So far, we just about hold it, but as I say, if, for example, there were to be major swings in the currency, then we would be in serious trouble. Now, just to answer the question, to say, but we anticipated that. Did we make any requests to the Treasury? All these items on this line are requests that we made to the Treasury, and the fact that they are in brackets in the last column indicates that we did not get the money. Of course, we can't complain too much. We have a deserved understanding because we understand the current financial situation. But nevertheless, we're just signaling that it gives us a lot of problems. So what essentially happened at the end, we made a request, and that's what was shown on this slide, of about 987 million. The Treasury gave us 300 million of that 987. But let me qualify. The 300 million is not for operations of the department. This is money that was added to the African Renaissance Fund as part of South Africa's budget support process to Zimbabwe. So that is what it is. Now, these slides I will not spend too much time on, Chair, but just to say, because the pattern has not changed, it will just show you that this is really the breakdown on our budget according to program. Program 1 deals basically with management, corporate services, human resources. Of the 5.3 billion I'm talking about, and we look at the last column, we are basically looking at about 1 billion that is going to spend on program one. Program two, which looks at the Americas and Europe to an extent, and this is not all of program two, this is the allocation to those, to basically that branch is 1.25 billion. And you can see that the money is really split between head office, for example, America's head office, America's mission, which means 229 million of the money we're spending in the Americas is spent in our missions, and only 18 million is spent in head office. The same with Europe, 22 million spent in head office and 5.1 million in the missions. This is what we are spending on our multilateral mission last year in New York and Geneva, a total of 141 million and 60 million in head office. Africa Multilateral, this is largely Addis Ababa and also our small mission here and our unit here at the headquarters. This is how much we are spending in Africa bilateral, 55 million in head office and 694 million in spending our missions in Africa. And in Asia, 685 million in missions. Let me stress that you will see that both Asia and compared to the previous ones, if you look at what we're spending on the Americas, what we're spending in Europe, and look at what we're spending in Asia and Africa, this has been a deliberate effort over the past few years to begin to increase our allocations to Africa and Asia as part of what the minister was referring to about the South-South there. And this is basically what we are spending on public diplomacy. We've got a lot of transfer funds. That these are funds that relate to our membership of different organizations. And we decided, again in the slides, that to, for your information members, I won't go through each one of them. You can pick up the one that you are interested in. Basically to indicate these are the commitments that we have, AU, UN, a number of other organizations that we support. And as you can see right at the end, our transfers amount to about a billion rand a year. Now, the last slide really on this, just to say on the financial side, to make a point, to emphasize the point that the minister made, that we are really under a lot of pressure, and this is threatening to our ability to meet our objectives. There's a new organizational structure that was approved by government. Increasingly, we are finding that as we fill the positions, it puts a lot of pressure on our operational budget. So our operational budget is really under pressure, and this is something that we would like us to look at. I am now approaching the end of this presentation, but just to say, in public diplomacy, we are going to have a lot of work related to FIFA, and we are gearing up for that, and we are interacting together with GCIS, with all the committees that FIFA has on this. There's a lot of work that we're doing on the marketing of South Africa abroad. There's the challenge of communicating our international relations framework to all South Africa stakeholders. There's a challenge that has been given by Cabinet to coordinate the work of projection of South Africa internationally, and I think this is just also a recognition that sometimes we send confused and mixed messages, and just to say that we are working also together with Parliament as part of the team that tries to coordinate the key messages that South Africa sends out. Of course, there is the support ongoing to make sure that the activities of our executive are projected. And then, of course, there's the managing of our brand. That's the work of our public diplomacy. On the state protocol, as you know, we are responsible for all incoming and outgoing state and official visits. We cover the president, the deputy president, then there's the work of our minister. Then we also give a lot of support to FIFA currently in the context of preparing for protocol work. We have a conferencing unit that also supports other government departments with respect to major conferences taking place. We have protocol lounges in Cape Town and Pretoria that we also manage. In Johannesburg. And then there's a protocol lounge that's going to be opened at the New Lamethi Airport by April 2010 in time for the FIFA World Cup. And then, of course, we maintain the presidential and our diplomatic guest houses. That is part of what we do. We also look after the diplomatic corps and will continue doing that. That is accredited to South Africa. All their entry points to the South African government is through our state protocol services. We administer the Diplomatic Immunities and Privileges Act and will do that on an ongoing basis. We also administer our national symbols, particularly state functions and also are the custodians of the official table of presidents. We manage presidential ceremonies. We work together with the presidency, for example, when incoming ambassadors have to present their letters of credence to the president. And an area that worried us in the past few years, probably 2 years, that we've had to work with the SAPS on, and we've built a strong unit now, the Diplomatic Protection Unit, has forced us to work together with the SAPS, related to unfortunate incidents that involved on the criminal side that involved the diplomatic corps. I think there's been some improvement, but no ground for us to be complacent yet. Chair, I'm conscious of the fact that really this has been a run through what is we hope is a far much more detailed presentation in the stress plan document, which we have tabled. And of course, as usual, as the minister promised, would be available. We know that it's not possible to cover in the detail we may wish all these areas, and would avail ourselves not only today but subsequently to get into further details on some of the issues. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thanks very much, TTE, for this comprehensive input on the programs and the whole storytelling of the department. Colleagues, just before we engage, let me first apologize that there was an apology as early as Monday of Honorable Makawabeta that she would not be available because of the medical engagement. So that apology was presented on time, and it should be accepted. So it's just a mistake from my side that it was a slip. The second one is, you would notice that both the Honorable Maite Nkwane Mashabane, the minister, just left as he had indicated, and Honorable Olomisa is the chair of the multi-party forum, which is just meeting now, but he forgot to talk about it. And then I must also, to the members of the committee, inform you or introduce two very important people who are working with this committee as a researcher seated right at the back. Mpo, stand up. That Mpo Mashaba will help you with some research to be done in the committee. And then we also have right in front Dineo Msala, termed as the content advisor. As to what it means, you'll be there with no time. You'll understand it. And let's come to some discussion, and maybe we must start with clarification after this input by the DG. We will take some little discussion, but remember, a lot of time has gone into putting this together. And you might also need a lot of time to look at it. But I know you would have questions to raise. And then I'll put it to you as the members of the committee to raise your clarity-seeking questions or any other issues or comment which you would love to raise before we come to the end and say what we're going to do with the whole report. Honorable member. Just introduce yourself as you speak, because we do not know one another well here. Most of us are new, fresh from the box, still very rough teaching. Even now we raise the issue. But in the process, we'll deal with the rough edges. Honorable Prof.
Thank you, Chair. At least I'm not one of those new DG. Thank you very much. Thank you, DG. Chairperson, I would like to thank the DG for a very comprehensive input. I just have a concern on consolidation of the African agenda, bullet number one, I think it's seven, where we are saying one of our key milestones is for the attainment of the African economic community and the rationalization and harmonization of that regional economy. My question to the DG is that recently I've seen members of the region, SADC, signing an economic partnership agreement with the European Union. So I would like to know where does that put us in as far as regional harmonization and rationalization that we are referring to here is concerned. And lastly, just a comment on the membership that we are paying. We are a member of the African, Caribbean, and Pacific countries, and our membership there is made through the Cotonou Agreement. I have learned, DG, in the past meeting with that institution that we have not ratified the agreement that makes us to be members. I would like to, you to comment on those. Thank you, Chair.
I have the following who had requested to speak. Honorable Mook, am I right? Followed by Honorable Korenov. Then Honorable Rev Moshe. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, DG, for that comprehensive presentation. Just a couple of things I'd like to raise and maybe get some clarification from you. I've noted that, of course, the South African government has intervened in a number of conflict situations on the continent, Rwanda, Burundi, Sudan, DRC, and so on and so forth. But your presentation is silent on Somalia. Somalia has had no central government for the past two decades or so. And as we speak now, Somalia is a failed state. And now it's impacting greatly on trade, for which South Africa is a major part, considering that our economy on the continent is one of the largest, in fact, if not the largest. Our ships take the route that is currently at the mercy of the pirates. I'd like to get a comment on that and what the government considers to do in Somalia. Second, I noticed in the reading that was given to us before this meeting that, of course, we are the host for the Pan-African Parliament, but that we seem to be the only country contributing tremendously, not only to the running of the PAP, but also, in fact, to the construction of the parliament in mid-range. My question is, are there any other sources of funding for this project other than what we are contributing? And my last one would be the Renaissance Fund, African Renaissance Fund. I know that a lot of that money has been used for the Southern Sudan capacity building project, for which I was very heavily involved myself in my previous life at UNISA, working with your office, Dr. Saluba. Other than just the Sudan project, where else does this money go? And do we have any other sources of funding for the continuation of projects like the GOS project, the Government of Southern Sudan project? And maybe finally, the last point is that I noticed that there are certain services that are provided by the department to citizens, one of which is the registration of South Africans traveling abroad. But my worry is that probably many of us who travel abroad are not aware of this service. That is there a better way of disseminating this information to the citizens? Thank you, Chair.
I'll go to Honorable Korenov. I've added in my list after Rev Moshe, Honorable Manana.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm also new in the committee, so my apologies for the rough edges. Handle it with care. My first question is more a political question, probably addressed to one of the two deputy ministers. And that is, over the weekend there was an article in the Sunday newspapers about a possible policy shift regarding the human rights abuses in some countries, and at least three countries were mentioned. Looking into the situation against the background of a global financial meltdown and the increasing instability, possible instability in some of the countries. Myanmar was one and two other countries to the north of our borders. I just need to know whether we are contemplating a shifting policy towards the human rights abuses against the global economic financial crisis and the possible greater instability in such countries, possibly spilling over to our country. That is the first question. The second question, I'm really excited about the DG wanting to put forward that we should rather, instead of renting foreign property, but to acquire them. It's a long-term investment, and I think it's a brilliant idea, and I would suggest that we engage with the DG as soon as possible about the properties involved, the asset register listed by the AG in his report, and if you can inform us in the medium term later this year the plans that you have and how this committee can assist you as a department to acquire properties in, I believe, in a phased approach against the pressure on your budget. And then the one on the MTF, the currency fluctuations. As far as I remember, this is not a new problem. It's been a problem with the department ever since, for many, many years already. Whether you've discussed it with the Auditor General, possibilities how to overcome this problem. I remember at this certain stage they were talk about not of fixing or estimating of currency levels, but then you risk to lose on a major basis. What discussions have emanated from your interaction with the Auditor General, how to address the currency fluctuation? Thank you.
Honorable Ramush.
Thank you, Chair. My first question has to do with the strengthening of political and economic relations. One of the countries where you've placed high priority on economic diplomacy is the Republic of Korea. I want to know whether it is the North or the South Korea. Because if it is North, I would be very curious to know what economic benefits we get from such a relationship. And the second question, one of my colleagues has touched on it, on Rosa. Why are the MPs at least not informed about Rosa? Because if we want the citizens to utilize its services, at least MPs' constituencies can also be used to inform the public about it. Actually, I heard about it for the first time today, and it sounds like it has been running for some time, so why are the MPs at least not informed about it? And my last question has to do with the schedule of proposed budget. There's a list of a number of organizations, but the million rents has been set aside for other international organizations. When other organizations have been listed, who are the other? And why are they not listed? Thank you.
Honorable Manana, who will add Honorable Makhalapa.
No, I'm covered, Chief, by Honorable Koronov.
Honorable Manana, not Comrade Manana, okay. Are you on board? Continue.
I was not sure, Chairperson, whether it's me because I'm Makama.
Yes. Sorry,
sir. Okay.
Makama.
Makama, yes. It's actually testimony to the fact that not only am I new to this committee, I'm brand new, out of the box member of parliament. Thank you, Chairperson. I have been partly covered by the member there, but I think there's two, three other questions that I would like to pose. One is, what is the department's strategy for promoting and assisting the inclusive government in Zimbabwe? There has been the global political agreement, which is in its implementation phase, as you know, with all the problems that still permeate the political life of Zimbabwe, such as the continued or reported continued violence and detention of opposition supporters and members. Now, the question really is what is our role? And how does the decision of the World Bank not to grant Zimbabwe funding, impact on perhaps bringing about political stability and supporting the global political agreement? The other question is, in his presentation, the DG mooted that there would be rapid response teams. What would the rapid response teams, what are they, in a sense? And then the other issue is that it has been mooted that there would be a mechanism created to centralize the foreign policy relations activities of all spheres of government. Are those mechanisms in place, and how far are they? Then lastly, Chairperson, is clearly there is a need to broaden the understanding on foreign policy relations of government amongst ordinary people. This is more importantly so because of the last hoo-ha that was there around the issue of the Dalai Lama. So is the department looking into it? Is there a plan in place? If so, what is it? Thank you.
Honorable Phyllis Musane.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, DG, for your presentation. Mine is under ambassadors in residence. And I just want to know, because here it says retired ambassadors and respected diplomats need to include admin. What is the situation now? I'm asking because here it says need to include admin. And another question is the budget. DJ, you said the budget for 2009 to 2010, 2010 to 2011, 2011 to 2012 is not really enough. How much do you think is needed to complete your budget? Thank you.
Thank you,
Chairperson. I think let me also join the chorus in congratulating the DG for giving us a comprehensive presentation. I've got five questions, Chairperson. I beg your indulgence. The first one is what will be the role of the South African Development Agency and how will it be funded? Because I don't see in the budget projections where will the development agency feature, because of we're running at a financial loss here. The second one is the clarity on the comment made that the mechanism aimed at centrally coordinating all the foreign relations activities of the provinces and local governments. I would want to hear clarity on that one. What does it mean basically? Does it mean that the provinces and the local governments are doing a free-for-all, or do we need to cut their wings? The third one is the issue of the public diplomacy approach. I've seen that we've cut about 10 million in as far as that is concerned. And I think the case in point of the Dalai Lama saga, it indicates that there is quite a very significant need to do public diplomacy in as far as making sure that the citizens are acquainted with our foreign policy. So I would want to see more emphasis in as far as the public diplomacy is concerned, because of there are always mixed signals and mixed messages that are being sent to the citizens. The first one is the issue of the acquiring of missions in Africa. I think we definitely need to put it in a more broader context than just putting it philosophically of enhancing the African agenda. What does it mean for us? What value for money is it that we are acquiring from acquiring these assets? So we need to make sure that whatever criteria that we follow in acquiring the assets in the African continent enhance our development agenda. The fifth one is the issue of monitoring. I see that we've got a lot of assets, and if you look at most of our budget will be spent on Africa and Asia. And my question is, are we monitoring that the money that we spend on those continents, is it well spent with reference to the AU, with reference to the African Renaissance Fund and what have you? So do we make sure that we monitor whether this money that we invest is largely used for the purpose that it is? And what are the challenges in as far as lack of monitoring, or if monitoring is done, what are the challenges that we are faced in making sure that our money is well spent? Thank you, Chairperson.
Let me add just one or two questions. We've been sharing, Sadek, what are the outputs on the areas of our work there? Can we be able to show as the chair of SADC? The last one would be a question put by Honorable Magama in a different, I put it in a different way. Foreign policy DG mostly involves what I would call state actors, state to state. But the question is, South Africans are a very politicized nation. What attempts are there to bring the ordinary mass on board? I see that when I was looking at the various previous reports, anybody involved beyond the state actors would be the business for economic interest. But you talk NGOs, civil society, and so on, there's very little. And maybe put it in different words, how do we adopt a mass-based approach? You see, I'm used to that language, mass-based. A mass-based approach to foreign policy or international relations in the new language. Yeah, I just wanted to raise those.
Chairperson, thank you very much. With the concurrence of the ministers, I'll start and the ministers will come later. And just I should have said that we have our DDG Ambassador Nene, DDG Multilateral, Ms. Nompo Zolo, DDG HR, DDG Corporate Services, Asogen Motley, Tandi Fadana, Chief Director of Finance, and Mr. Gosso, who's our Head of Internal Audit, and Nomfanelo, who is the acting head of public diplomacy, Nomfanelo got. So they, I might invite them to come in, and they will also feel free to expand on some of the points. Maybe let me start with the first point. I think we're working on the basis that we are full signatories. We are the founder member of the AU, and in the Constitutive Act, we reaffirmed the principles, for example, of the Abuja Treaty around the establishment of an African Economic Community. So we are committed to that. Now, and we also hold the view that the regional economic communities like SADC, COMESA, are the building blocks of that. Now, obviously, in the process, it's not a linear process, and I think the Honorable Member is highlighting one of the contradictions and tensions that exist in that process. That whilst we are committed to strengthen our SADC region as an RSC, as a building block to the African Economic Community, we find that even within SADC, there are several contradictions. And not only within SADC, and sometimes even within the smaller families as a subsector of SADC, which is the SACU, there are certain contradictions. And one of those contradictions that we're trying to manage is this with respect to this signing of the Economic Partnership Agreement, EPAS, with the EU. Now, we know that three countries in our region, Lesotho, Swaziland, and Botswana, have seen it in their best national interest to sign those agreements. We've had certain reservations, and I think it's something that is going to seize us as we move on, and I think it has got many implications, for example, for the stability and the continued coherence of SACU. It will call for, at some point, a significant reflection by our political leaders to look at what the full implications of this are. And so I think, indeed, that is where we are on the issue. So, as the Honorable Member pointed out, there are those tensions, but I think we're trying to see how best to manage them as we move forward. Yes, indeed, there is a problem with our ratification. My understanding is that will be if we have not formally approached Parliament to speed up the ratification of related to the Cotonou Agreement. Now, in the case of Somalia, we have there's a paragraph that was put on page 18 on the statement. But essentially, what we are really trying to do, there are three things in Somalia. First of all, we've interacted as late as April with the current government in Somalia. And we've, in fact, before the flaring up of the current conflicts, we were discussing the formal opening of a diplomatic mission for Somalia here. Our view was that that could then be used as a springboard for opening up a number of areas of cooperation in which we could help. Secondly, we fully support the initiative, largely under the auspices of the AU, related to the, for example, the deployment of AMISOM in Somalia. Of course, we have indicated that in South Africa, we're not yet in a position or we're not in a position to put troops on the ground because of our commitments in Darfur, DRC, and Burundi, and the numbers that are involved in that. So I think we're following the processes very closely. We had indicated at some point, I think our government is still considering the issue of whether, in fact, we'll participate now that there's a UN resolution as part of the international effort, particularly on the patrolling to open up the humanitarian corridor to allow the World Food Program ships and things like that to come in. So that is what we've also taken a strategic view on Somalia, that perhaps our support as South Africa must be far much more support for the initiatives either of the AU or of IGAD, so that we do not open too many confusing lines with respect to what should be done in Somalia. Now, the issue of the Pan-African Parliament is that we've got certain obligations as a country that is hosting it. There were certain commitments we needed to make at the time when we were making the bid. These commitments are captured in a host country agreement that was signed with the AU, one of them being the fact that we'll provide the premises and other services. Now, obviously, there are some of the services of the Pan-African Parliament that are funded through the mainstream budget of the African Union. So I think as far as I'm concerned, those would be the two major sources of the funding for the Pan-African Parliament. It is a significant commitment for South Africa. And I think we have been engaging in a debate on how to make sure that actually that significant commitment translates into something that is concrete, that serves what was intended in terms of the role of the Pan African Parliament in the continent. Now, on the issue of the sources of the African Renaissance Fund, the program in Sudan, honorable member, if I may, who else are we funding through the ARF? There are quite a number of other activities. Those will be captured, I think some of them would be captured in our annual report of the ARF fund, the one that we have tabled before, but I know that we are preparing now for the 08-09 annual report, and that will also detail. For example, we are funding huge projects in Guinea-Conakry. Some of them is trilateral agreement with the Vietnamese on rice cultivation. We are funding work in Rwanda and Sierra Leone. We are funding a lot of work in the DRC, largely through the services and also DPSA in the area of civil service centers, I mean, amongst others. So there's a whole host of areas. And of course, we have had large commitments this time around supporting the program in Zimbabwe. Now, there are some countries that we have partnered with on a trilateral arrangement. So there are some countries, particularly the Nordics, that have been comfortable to say if South Africa is making a contribution, they would also come in, and so we become trilateral partners. For example, in the support that has been given to Burundi, for example, maintaining the office of the facilitator and all the work that has happened in Burundi, we're working together with the Dutch, and they've co-funded some aspects of that program. In the work we're doing in the DRC around the civil service, or the work that we've been doing with the police, for example, in Rwanda and also the DRC, we find that the streets have come on board to work together with us. So there are a few of these trilateral agreements. In the case of the doctor program in Rwanda, for example, we're working together with the Cubans. With respect to the Mali doctor program, again, we're working with the Cubans. So depending on the area, we then sometimes leverage trilateral cooperation. Let me take as a comment, a criticism, and advice the issue around the dissemination of the information around the services that we provide to South African citizens. I'm sure Lomfanelo has listened very carefully to that, between our public diplomats and the consular services. The fact that, indeed, it has been raised, and the issue around the fact that even the honorable members don't know about the services that we are providing under the ROSA scheme, and disengagement, and I take the point as valid that indeed the members can play a very important role to make sure that the constituencies are aware of these services for South Africans when they go abroad. So we will improve on that. And maybe let me, whilst I'm on that point of the interaction, deal with two other issues. The first one is that the minister has, as part of the refocus of the, or rather part of the refocus, yes, of the mandate of the department, the minister has raised the issue, and the deputy minister, strongly about the focus with South African civil society. First of all, to make sure that the South African public understands the elements of our foreign policy. So, in terms of our program of work, you will see far much more of the work driven through our public diplomacy unit. More or less a modified version of the Indizotide program, to make sure that we really focus on South Africans. And indeed, as the honorable members pointed out, perhaps the discourse around the East of the Dalai Lama did reflect some of these difficulties. And so I think we take that as a weakness of the department that we need to correct. And so too is the point that has been raised by the honorable chairperson around the, yes, we are talking about the role of the state, we are talking about business and economic, but what about the other elements of non-state actors like civil society, for example, far much more broadly. And indeed, in terms of, and this is an area that we'll be focusing on, bearing in mind that the issue around foreign policy, international relations now, is characterized, first of all, by just its complexity. It's no longer an issue just about politics, or if there is element of politics in so many issues. There's the issue of energy security, there's the issue of climate change, apart from the traditional economic diplomacy and political diplomacy. So, and we need to be ready to engage. But the second characteristic is that actually it's gone beyond the point where it is just the state actors that are active. And as the chair correctly pointed out, business is involved, but so too are structures of civil society. A lot of the interaction, and so one of the things we've been discussing, that it is actually not possible to have an effective message going outside if it is not linked with a strong domestic mobilization of the whole of society, understanding the fundamental underpinnings of our international relations work. So again, this is an area of weakness that we'll be trying to look at. I take the point, Honorable Kornoff, we indeed come back to the committee around the issue of the properties. You are correct that the issue of the currency fluctuation has been a long-standing issue. I think the problem that we got caught up in, particularly this year, is the fact that in our system of governance, there are two windows. We've got the budget vote in February, and then the adjustment estimate in September and October. When the adjustment estimate, and normally if there's the currency change during that period, during the adjustment estimate, the finance minister then would make a correction, maybe an upward, and it would come as an adjusted budget to the department. This time around, the biggest knock to the rent came after the adjustment estimate. So essentially, we dealt with 4 or 5 months. We've been interacting with the Auditor General, with the Treasury, but the fact of the matter, there is no mechanism in our system for that sort of correction that becomes legitimized necessary. And I think that's the difficulty that we've tried to navigate with the Treasury. But I don't think it's so much been an insensitivity to an extent. But of course, moving forward, our argument is that even the rand, dollar, rand, euro exchange that they've used to calculate the MTF budget are still too conservative. I think they are going to land us in problem. I think that's the bigger problem that we're trying to deal with. Yes, we do have relations with both the Republic of Korea and the Democratic Republic of Democratic People's Republic of Korea. In this case, we're talking about South Korea, the Republic of Korea. Reverend Mr. Honorable Member. Who are the other international organizations? That other international organizations, these are, we have got the list of them, Honorable Member, but these are, sometimes we find we've got organizations where we're just giving 50,000 rands, and we thought just for the sake of the presentation, we will just consolidate them into that, but we've got all that information. Now, maybe Mr. Modi will talk about the rapid response. Maybe let me deal with this issue of coordination of international relations work across the different spheres. Basically, some time back, in 2007, July to be precise, the international relations cluster of departments made a presentation to the cabinet, Lukhutra. And in that we said that one of the biggest constraints we are beginning to experience in the execution and implementation of our foreign policy is the fact that our messages sometimes are contradictory. Whether it's in the area of tourism promotion, you find that provinces, as they bid against each other, they actually send negative stories about another, sometimes inadvertently, just by looking at the brochure. Secondly, is that because of the plethora of people from local governments, provinces, and who go to countries, now sometimes people move without any interaction with the foreign foreign ministry there. And then you find that actually we get signals from our ambassadors that some of the statements that might have been made were a bit unfortunate, sometimes insensitive to nuances in that particular country, things that we could have managed if there was a bit of better coordination. So we were charged with doing that. So there was a framework and policy guidelines that were presented and adopted by Cabinet in November last year. We've made reference to those guidelines in the recent Cabinet retreat. And so the idea is that, and we formulated those together with the different spheres. We had meetings chaired by the Foreign Ministry, and that included all the different spheres of government. So the buy-in into them should not be too difficult. So one of the tasks that we've put for our department and our cluster, international relations cluster for this year, is really to drive the implementation of that coordination framework. And it has got a number of elements, for example, sometimes very basic things. Delegations go to our missions, and the first time that our missions hear about them is when the delegations are already in the country. Quite clearly, our missions are not in a position then to give them the requisite support. Sometimes people not getting advice, even delegations, the timing of the visits of delegations not negotiated so as to allow our missions also to service those delegations when they get there, which then, again, makes people not to get the full benefit. And also not for our missions and South Africa generally to get the full benefit, because even if it's a premier, for argument's sake, from KZN, who's going to a particular area. That's a political leader in our system of government. So our mission may wish, in addition to the province-specific issues, may wish to utilize that visit to break through certain avenues that our mission would like to look at, and so also with prominent people who are coming from South Africa. So it is that we really want to focus on. The instruction that we had from Cabinet when we started this work was that let's do coordination, but let's not create something that is too bureaucratic a monster that it stifles innovation. And I think in the consultation we've had with the different spheres and other governments, we found a bit of a happy medium of those two. But maybe, again, Chairperson, because I think the guidelines have got a number of elements that have been agreed, and it may well be we would be available to come and discuss with the committee in the detail those guidelines. The retired, the 0910, our rough estimate was that at the absolute minimum, if we had had another 150 million rand, probably it would help us tide us for the 0910 financial year. Now, on the South African Development Partnership Agency, its role and how it will be funded, those are some of the things that we are thinking through now, and with a view that we will present that, as I indicated, sometime early November to the executive. We are part of what we are trying to do, for example, on Monday this week, I was having discussions with the Director General of CEDA, just looking at how the streets are looking and how they've managed their development work. What are the key lessons that, as we try to look at this, bearing in mind that ours will have a slightly different political slant, and also bearing in mind that our focus might actually be far much more narrow looking at the continent. But so that work, I think, will become clearer. And so, too, has to be the issue whether there will be a legislative framework. There's an issue that we're going to debate in the course of this year, which is whether the SADPA will coexist with the African Renaissance Fund, or the existence of SADPA will imply, therefore, the ARF should be folded into the start. But that discussion, I think, is one of the things that we'll be sorting out. I take the issue of Africa and Asia and the issue of assets and our wealth generally, whether we're getting value for money. Our first reaction would be that let me start with Asia. Asia definitely is huge value for money. If you look at the trade patterns, And what our growing presence in Asia has done with diversifying South Africa's trade relations and economic relations. In fact, in Asia, our biggest problem, this year we're contained by the financial situation. We had planned to open up further missions, both in China and India, satellite missions, because of the possibilities that we see in both those countries. We have also started the process, for example, I think last year we sent our first ambassador to Sri Lanka, of opening up in other areas. Now, in Africa, yes, there is economic work. A lot of it, for example, our intra-Africa trade for South Africa generally has increased to the level where it's still relatively small, but it's about 15% now. It has shown development, growth over the past few years. But I think that part of the investment in Africa also has to be about the political relations. Because, in a sense, I think it is true that part of the international recognition that we enjoy as South Africa, and therefore the space we have to be a global player, has to do first, of course, with the power of example of what we're doing here at home with respect to our constitutional dispensation and what we are doing, but also more importantly is because we're seen as a regional power, as an influential player in Africa, both in political and economic terms. And so part of the investment we're making in the continent is also an investment for the future. Chairperson, you raised the issue of our chairing of SADC. I think when we started chairing SADC, we gave ourselves five tasks. One was that we are going to work consciously on the issue of cohesion of SADC. At the time we took over the chair, our own assessment was that there were difficulties in SADC on account of two issues. One was the problem in Zimbabwe, which was beginning to create internal difficulties in SADC. And the other one, the honorable member referred to, was the issue of EPAS. We've not been able to resolve the issue of EPAS to our satisfaction, although even there was a bit of progress made. But I think we've money to work around the east of Zimbabwe so that there's far much more cohesion, which is why you see so much priority from our chairship. The second issue that we thought we wanted to focus on a bit was the issue of how we can move fast on the issue of the Univisa so that indeed when the World Cup takes place in South Africa in 2010, the Soccer World Cup, we can be true at the regional level to the fact that this is an African World Cup. And the way to translate the African World Cup is to make sure that the spin-off, starting with people coming for that, and subsequently, that the tourism spin-off that may be in the years to come, do not only benefit South Africa, but benefit our region. So there's been the issue of the Univisa, and also a lot of work that has been done by our tourism minister to try to facilitate that. Now, there will be a report back in August in the SADC Summit on how far, but there has been some progress on that work also. The third area that, or third and fourth area has been, and again we did not complete it, but we think that it will be completed by sometime in October, November. We wanted to drive very hard on the issue of the creation of the project preparatory fund of SADC as a way, and also the development of a SADC development fund, as a way of ensuring that we've got a far much more streamlined way of funding and also doing feasibility studies, especially on the investment that improves the productive capacity in the region, particularly the infrastructure, roads network, the energy network, and so on. So those are some of the things. Some of them we've met fully, some not exactly to the extent that we'd wanted. Of course, one of the biggest derailers that we did not expect at the time was the issue of Madagascar, which is consuming a lot of the time of our minister currently. I think, Chair, I dealt with the issue of the non-state actors. But maybe just the last point, and my ministers would probably add to that, is just to say that the issue about the strategy for assisting Zimbabwe and the decision of the World Bank not to grant, remember that we, in the SADC summit that was here, that we hosted in February, we articulated maybe three, four positions that were aligned to our national position, but were broadly SADC positions on Zimbabwe, and that's what we're pursuing. The first one was that we should really make sure that the inclusive government works, and we must make sure that we put as much pressure as possible to the inclusive government to be consistent both with the letter and spirit of that agreement. Now, a lot has been done, but there are some challenges. Now, there are the more recent challenges that have been referred to around, for example, the reemergence of the issue of violence. And I think that's a new phenomenon. There was a time when things seemed to be stabilized, to be stabilizing in that area. So I think we must keep a close watch on that. The second issue was for us as South Africa to lead by example. We committed that we will, as we mobilize the rest of the international community, as South Africa and as the region, contribute to that reconstruction. Hence I'm saying, for example, we've allocated 300 million rand for the budget support. This is in addition to the 300 million rand that was given for the agricultural input in December. So in a short space of 6 months, South Africa has actually committed and contributed 600 million rand to the immediate stabilization of Zimbabwe. So I think that was the second one. The third area that we've been working on is to talk to all the international role players and basically to urge them that they should not adopt a wait-and-see attitude. The major donors, people must re-engage in Zimbabwe. There are many ways to re-engage with Zimbabwe. Some people are still not happy with elements of the political solution. We respect that. But there's certainly humanitarian interventions that are directed at the people of Zimbabwe, that the people should not be holding back on. And so we convey that message consistently. And the fourth one was to regularize the issue of Zimbabwe with the major international funders. It was clear to us that for the economic reconstruction of Zimbabwe, yes, we can do whatever we can do. There's a discussion about lines of credit. Other countries can do the same. But more fundamentally, Zimbabwe must regularize itself with the major international funders. So that is why in the meeting that was in March or April, our Minister of Finance was one of the key people, then Minister Trevor Manuel, worked very hard together with other ministers to make sure that the IMF makes some change in Zimbabwe with respect to Zimbabwe. And that was achieved. It is true that the World Bank has not followed suit, But at least we now are in a situation where the IMF and the African Development Bank are reconsidering, and in fact they've sent missions already to Zimbabwe with a view to defining what is the nature of engagement. And our view is that indeed we want to support Zimbabwe to regularize, because again, our fundamental policy would be that as we support Zimbabwe, we basically support Zimbabwe so that Zimbabwe is in a position to look after itself, so that Zimbabwe exercises its full sovereignty. And part of exercise of that full sovereignty would be for it to open its own lines of discussion together with this, with some of the major international funders. So I think those are the issues that I've noted. I thought I would respond to. But I'm part of it.
If the deputy ministers would like to make any comment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Chair. The DG, I think, has covered many of the questions that were raised here. And may I say that it looks like we're going to have a very engaged 5 years, because the committee seems to be well informed and extremely interested in the work of our international relations. I wanted to say one word on the EPAs. I think the Honourable Member is entirely correct. We have got a difference of opinion among SACU members and amongst those are SADC members on the benefits for our trade with the European Union. South Africa, as you know, has already a TDCA, a trade agreement. And so we're in a different position to some of our neighbours. What we need to do now is to work with those neighbours on ways in which we can best resolve the problem, and to inform the members here that we have an interministerial committee that is working on this, that includes the Minister of Trade and Industry, it includes the Minister of International Relations, as well as the Treasury and Agriculture. And we think that given the deep political commitment we have in our region, we should be able to resolve those problems into the future. But it is a stumbling block. I wanted to just mention also the question raised by Honourable Member Kuhnhoff regarding a policy shift in terms of human rights. And really, I think that in many ways we are held hostage to the media's interpretation of what we do and say. Because if you look on page 6 of the Strat Plan, one of the principles, the first principle underpinning South Africa's international relations is a commitment to the promotion of human rights. This is not new. This is something that we have always had. In the case of Myanmar, I myself summoned the Myanmar ambassador 2 years ago when there was a massacre of the people in the streets of their capital to really underscore South Africa's displeasure at the way in which that military junta is dealing with the circumstances there. Sometimes these things are not fully reported, and sometimes we also forget our interaction on this matter. Deputy Minister Ibrahim can also Deputy Minister Ibrahim will also maybe talk to his interaction with the new Myanmar ambassador. But let us never forget our commitment to human rights has always been there. It's not a policy shift. It is something that underpins our constitution and the very fundamental basis of our foreign policy, which is based on our domestic policy. So I think we should be very clear about that. I want to support everything the DG said about our engagement with Zimbabwe, but just to add to that, that in addition to the 300 million last year and the additional 300 million budget support this year, we have offered a credit line of 500 million rand, if I'm not mistaken, DG, in assisting the Zimbabwean government to acquire credits, because that was one of their most difficult areas in which they are which they have been finding lately. And this is all going to contribute, we believe, to the stabilization of that economy and therefore the revival of that economy. I think it's important what was mentioned about the coordination of our foreign relations in terms of our different spheres of government. And DG did cover that in some length, and we think that the forum that we've established to engage on this matter amongst the different spheres is going to allow us to deal with some of the difficulties that we've had in the past. The DG also raised the question of the role of SADCA, and one of you questioned where the money was going to come from if it was not a budget item. And so I would really like to draw your attention to the fact, in the light of what the DG said, that the African Renaissance Fund has been budgeted for over the three-year medium-term period, 631, 431, and then 615 in the outlying year. So some of this money already exists. In fact, in our engagement with the DRC, we had six government departments contributing to the renewal of that country around about the election time, from the police services to the IEC to home affairs to public service and administration. So these budget items exist. What we need is coherence and coordination in regard to the way we use this money, and also the impact that we can have by leveraging it with trilateral cooperation, with, as the DG mentioned, with some of our partners in the north. There was one other question that was raised about the outputs. I think it was you, Chair, the outputs from SADC. And just to say, all the things that DG said are absolutely true, and then let us not forget that we did launch a free trade area in August last year at the beginning of our chairing of that of the SADC group. The EPAs continue to challenge us, but we will be moving forward in a more coordinated way with this new interministerial committee. I think that you raise another very important question, Chair, and I think DG has dealt with it, but I would just like to underscore the importance of the way in which we as South Africa engage in the international community, state to state, but also non-state actors. And you have mentioned some of them. It is civil society, and that includes the unions, incidentally, which I thought I should mention to you. And it includes, of course, engagement through business and that interaction. But let's also not forget the media, because the media is a participant in the way in which South Africa is seen and the way in which we see other countries. It is something that we are hoping to take forward in the next 5 years and really deepen our engagement with non-state actors in South Africa to look at ways in which we can better work together to promote South Africa's brand abroad. Those were just a few remarks from my side. Thank you very much, Chair.
I can underscore what the Deputy Minister has said. There hasn't been any shift in our human rights policy or concern. Of course, if you look at the first slide and the first bullet point, that our commitment to the promotion of human rights. Of course, we have to express our concern where there are human rights violations, no matter where it takes place in the world. Whether it's in Myanmar, whether it's in Sri Lanka, whether it's in Palestine or in Iraq. But at the same time, we do offer our assistance in trying to resolve conflict peacefully wherever they take place. So I think it was the question of public diplomacy, as somebody said. Maybe in the past we have not actually engaged in public diplomacy, explaining our position as far as human rights are concerned. But as South Africans, and arising out of our firm commitment in our constitution on human rights, we would express our concern and condemnation of human rights violations that are taking place, and also at the same time offer whatever assistance we can to resolve the conflict wherever there are conflict that takes place in other parts of the world. That's what I just wanted to add, Chair.
I know we have the constraints of time, but there might be people wanting some second bite. Is there anybody who wants to? Let me just raise two issues on my side. We've been talking about this issue, and there's been a lot of publicity on this issue, DG. Any progress in because there's a lot of expectations in relation to that. You're talking about programs and any criteria which is being used by our own government in terms of how to fund particular programs, and are we able to monitor whether what we use is having the desired results? That's one. I used to raise it from where I'm coming as in my other hat as the president of the World Teachers Body. There's been a lot of interest, everybody wanting to conference in South Africa. And I see even in your plans, there are a lot of conferences we likely to have. Now the question is, are we having the desired results, or is just conferencing for the sake of conferencing? Because you tend to have a lot of these international organizations wanting to come to South Africa just for the sake. Lastly, I'm told when we're looking at some of your documents that there was this head office campus project where you're supposed to be occupied by a certain time this year. How far is that? How far is that working? Yeah. The last one is the most debatable issue now today in international relations and foreign policy, is towards the end of the year 2008, both the Israel and Palestinian representatives gave some report in the third parliament about their understanding of the situation in the Middle East. But Israeli representatives have expressed some discomfort on what they or with our policy. Some discomfort and feeling that we are a bit hostile in dealing with them. Where are the processes? And apparently the Israeli ambassador reported in the committee his displeasure at the manner which he claimed he was treated by Pretoria following that big war with Hamas. And how are we managing that? How are we managing that? And it's like now there's a stalemate, and it's a big question. And you were saying we will have to talk about the attempts in terms of furthering our agenda in relation to that question. But it's a question of interest everywhere. Whether you're a trade unionist, you're a tourist, you come across this thing about Israeli-Palestine question. I'm just interested in those areas. There is, Comrade Honorable Magama, you remain my comrade, don't worry. Honorable.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I was actually hoping that the DG or one of his officials would shed some light on the rapid response teams. So that's the one. The other one is the reform in the system of world governance. We know that there has been a process undertaken or initiated by our good selves, South Africa, with, of course, other socially developing countries in the world, that relates to certain fundamental reforms that have to be undertaken in the context of the UN governance and governance structures. Could the DG perhaps highlight us in terms of progress made in that regard?
Chairperson, let me start by apologizing, and I'll ask African immediately after I make the input, we'll deal with the rapid response teams, and I'll request Ambassador Nene to just deal with the issue of the U.S. reform. I'll venture on some of these, and of course the deputy ministers will try to fill up on that. On the head office campus, as I said, the chair, we will be moving into the new building. All of us will be in it by the 26th of June. So, in fact, the migration will start earlier than that. It might start as early as next week. Now the conference is in South Africa. You know, during the last cabinet retreat, if I may, just to say that from the tourism perspective, the issue of conference tourism has been elevated in South Africa. And of course, we are very happy with that. It's a growing area, and it's an area that South Africa can actually strategically place itself, largely because of the experience that generally people who come for conferences first, they tend to come with their families subsequently on tourism. And I think it's because of the nature of people who come to these conferences, you can easily profile the country. So our sense is that this has been a good investment, and I think the returns are there. Now, on our side as a department, last year, we had some sort of reflection from the point of view of marketing. And in fact, this came out in the discussion we had with the other spheres of government when we were talking about this coordination. And I think there's a criticism there that we need to respond to. And the criticism was that sometimes because these conferences, the big conferencing centers are in Cape Town, Johannesburg, and Durban, that sometimes we do not create enough space for the other provinces to present possibilities in their provinces as part of what we generally do around those conferences. And I think that is a weakness. That is something that we need to correct, especially if we start linking the issue of conferencing to longer term, to the bigger issue of conferences. So we generally tend to encourage, and as you know, most of the times when there's a major conference, for example, now that my minister has referred to your past, one of your fellow members, Denosa, the nurses, we know that they're having a major conference. The International Nursing Organization is meeting in Durban now in June. Now, you'll find that for big conferences like those, probably 2-3 years during the bidding process, there would be an approach to us to write as a government endorsement letter. So we tend to do that. And our missions play a big role sometimes in lobbying support in some of the targeted areas. So we tend to encourage it because of those spin-offs. Now, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, maybe let me just say, and here I would really say a few things and probably our ministers to add to this. But I just want to draw on, we are familiar with the criticism from the Israeli ambassador. There's supposed to be a regular consultation at DG level between us and Israel. Sometimes these meetings don't take place because sometimes it's very difficult to have these meetings in the middle of a major conflagration. But during the two meetings that we've had, just to cite them as an example, the Israeli side will come very strongly at us on the issue of what they call our voting pattern in the UN. Now, when we vote in the UN, we vote on issues of principle. Now, indeed, if at that point in time, the issue before us forces us, or rather to express our own principles, that we must vote for a resolution that's critical of their conduct, so we do that. Secondly, I think it is a fact that we also have been strong in articulating the issue of the right to self-determination of the people of Palestine. Now, But I think, to be fair, I think we always point out to the Israeli ambassador here that, in fact, in the past, both Deputy Minister Sufan Amer and, to a large extent, Deputy Minister Bahad, had so many meetings with the Jewish lobby groups in South Africa. And we've tried at all times to make sure that by the time we arrive at a policy position or a statement, it is as informed as possible by what is happening on the ground now. So I think I don't think there's any of the statements that we've made in the past that would regard as being very reckless, reflecting anti-Israeli sentiments. What we reflect is on an issue that prevails at that time. That is why also the government up to now has resisted, and there's been a pressure from some of the lobby groups and some of the structures of civil society in South Africa, at times for us to withdraw our ambassador from Israel. But precisely because our view has always been underpinned by the need for us to keep the lines of dialogue open and to promote dialogue between the Israelis and the Palestinians, we have not gone down that road. And it is not a position that is not contested in South Africa, as you know, Chair. So these issues, we've always said to them, they must understand and they must appreciate. But at the same time, we'll be firm on the issues of the self-determination. Of course, one of the things that they did not like is the fact that we're one of the countries that put a submission in the International Court against the war. But we said it's not possible for us to support or to be silent on the continued building of the wall or the issue of expansion of settlements when at the same time we are saying the basis of our engagement is this two-state solution based on the existing decisions, particularly the Oslo decisions, and also the positions that underpin the work of the Quartet. So I think sometimes when this is said, it's far much more to want us to be silent on issues of principle. We have equally, where there have been acts that we thought were extreme, on the side of the Palestinians, targeting civilians, we've equally condemned those acts also. So I think that is where we have been on this issue. The ambassador indeed has raised some of these issues, and that is the sort of response we've given to him. On the issue of the AU structures, Chairperson, there is a debate in the AU. I mean, there's a more fundamental problem in the AU, if I may say, and that is that the debate, even now when our heads of state are going to meet in Libya, is going to be the debate on the AU government. Now, the issue of the AU government, those of us who are like South Africa have been reluctant to embrace that in the short term, we take it as a medium to longer term goal to be achieved, have argued precisely the point that is implied in your question, which is that the AU and the Constitutive Act establishes certain structures to underpin the work of the AU. Before we can run and start talking about an AU government, it's important for us to focus on operationalizing the existing structures, because the existing structures, if they were to be all fully functional, starting with the Commission, it would help the advance the issue of continental integration. Unfortunately, sometimes you get a sense that when people are frustrated with making these structures work, they think jumping this necessary work to something else will resolve the problem. And this has been part of the dilemma in the AU debate. Let me say that on our side, we are not fully satisfied with the extent to which all the structures of the AU are functional. Starting with the Commission, and we've expressed this view, and in fact, if you look at the details of our threat plan, one of the things that we continuously put in our program of work is to continue to look for avenues that would enable us in South Africa to help with strengthening this structure. Whether it is the African Court on Human and People's Rights, whether it's the Commission itself, there's a discussion going on now that we said we need to formalize South Africa's position about the creation of the financial institution. All these structures of the AU are characterized really by some degree of weakness. One of the major reasons for these weaknesses is that the AU is over-dependent on funding from our collaborating partners. Every time we go to the AU, there's always, when it comes to the budget situation, is that there's always a cutting of all the promises or the commitments that. So, because we're not funding it adequately, even, for example, if you look at the issues of peacekeeping, the truth of the matter is that even the work that we're doing that the continent has been able to do in Darfur, which is admirable work in terms of sending the African peacekeepers at the beginning before the UN agreement. The truth of the matter is that had the EU not intervened with the peace facility, we would not have been able to sustain those troops on the ground. So I think it's those challenges that we need to deal with. But as I said, maybe the colleagues can.
Given time, the last one from my side, the Madagascar, and you have the issue of, call it what now, Western Sahara, Sarawak, Sarawak. Yes. How do you hope to bring about change there, given what's going on in most of that, Morocco, for instance, which seems to be enjoying some good relations with the North, seems not to be on board. Just the last one from me. Because it's an issue we've long been talking about of Western Sahara. Yes. Honorable Mubu.
Thank you, Chair. Just my last 2 points I also want to raise. It's around the issue of Sudan. I know there's an international warrant of arrest on the president of Sudan at the moment. And I see that in the last week he was in Zimbabwe. What is the position of the South African government on this? Do we support that resolution to arrest the president for violations of human rights in Darfur? And if he stepped on our soil, would he be arrested? Second, I sense from your presentation, DG, that you sounded a little bit apprehensive that the southern part of Sudan might decide to secede when they have their referendum. Is it next year, I think, 2011? Is this the feeling, the government, that they want South to be part of the Greater Sudan, or are we going to respect the feelings of the southerners to remain an independent state? Thank you.
No, let me start with the very last one. On Southern Sudan, our policy position is that at the end of the day, we will respect the right of the Southern Sudanese to make a choice. And once they've made that choice, I think South Africa will fully respect that. The issue that I was just trying to raise is that some of our apprehension is that as Southern Sudan exercises that choice, if you look at all the signals that we are getting, is that might actually in itself, legitimate as would be in terms of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, it might be the beginning of the second phase of conflict. And that is part of what really worries us. But that we respect the rights of the people of Southern Sudan. I'll allow the ministers to deal with the issue of the warrant of arrest in the Sudan. But on the Western Sahara and Madagascar, maybe just to say on Western Sahara, Chair, we took a decision to fully recognize the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic. And that ended the wrath of Morocco. As you know, Morocco withdrew their ambassador. And as you know, also we've reported that Morocco is not given us an agreement for an ambassador in Rabat. But we've got missions in both respective countries. Now, I think the only framework that we're working on to support Western Sahara is to operate, because we've argued strongly that Western Sahara situation must be resolved in the context of international legality as captured in UN resolutions. And we should not allow a deviation from that to the extent that emphasizes the right to self-determination. Now, we are products of a long protracted struggle on the right to self-determination. I think we'd be the last people to want to close the avenues for anybody to exercise that right. So we are strong on that. And that, of course, has ended sometimes the wrath, as I said, of Morocco. But we don't see how else from a principled position of South Africa. We believe any within that context, any compromises that are made on the east of Western Sahara have to come from the people of Western Sahara, should not be imposed by anybody external to them. And that is why also we've been worried of late that repeatedly in the UN, we voted for the extension of the UN mission in Western Sahara, largely because we think the current environment where there's some sort of ceasefire is much as it has not given us the result, but it's probably the desired way, and that we should not have that situation revert back to arms. So that is it. But what we're also doing in the short term is that we're running a number of projects on the humanitarian assistance side to just alleviate the plight of the people of Western Sahara, especially those who are in the camps in Tindouf. So that's really what we're doing. So when we're in the Security Council, in the UN, these are positions of the non-aligned movement. All those positions, South Africa is at the forefront of advancing those positions to help resolve the issue of Western Sahara. Now, the issue of Madagascar is, and again, maybe just to say, the issue of Madagascar for us is difficult from two points of view. The first one is that we are convinced that what we need is a far much more politically driven solution in Madagascar. And I think the developments of the past few months have shown us that even the incumbent president would know that it probably is easier to get power in the manner that he did, but it's far much more difficult to keep the power and protect it once you are there. And we think we need to break through that cycle. And the only way is to go through a political solution. SADC has decided on sending a special envoy on the ground, which is the former Prime Minister of Swaziland, Dlamini. Now, I think, as I understand, there is probably in the next few weeks, or if not next or so, consideration for a high-level engagement in SADC on Madagascar. And probably around that time, things will be clearer as to the concrete intervention by SADC. But we continue to be worried. We think it's a political solution. We're trying as much as possible to discourage this inclination of thinking that can be resolved militarily. You can probably intervene militarily and do something in the short term, but in the longer term, I think we need to get all the players around. The other difficulty in Madagascar that I know that the SADC is working on is that there are basically four different envoys on the ground in Madagascar. There's one of the UN, there's one of the AU, there's one of SADC, and there's one of the Francophonie. And it's not on every issue that those envoys are pointing in the same direction. And I think we just need to contain that so that the message to the people and the leadership of Madagascar is a coherent message from the international community.
Thank you. I'm concerned about the question on the rapid response team, which I can't answer. So we'll get into this. And the global governance. But I would just like to address the matter of the warrant of arrest for President al-Bashir. Honourable members will be aware that South Africa is a signatory to the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court. We were also, however, party to a decision at the African Union that said that we believed that the International Criminal Court should hold off on an arrest warrant until such time as the opportunity to achieve a peaceful solution in the Darfur region was achieved. We were part of that decision. However, the decision having been made by the International Criminal Court that a warrant for arrest should be issued against President al-Bashir means that we are bound by our international obligations. And we have informed the Sudanese that we would be bound by that statute, and therefore he would risk arrest if he did come to South Africa. This is something that we do in the same time as we attempt to put all our facilities and our expertise into resolving the problems in Darfur. But as a responsible global citizen, we are compelled, in terms of our international obligations, to fulfill that obligation. Thank you.
Yes, Ambassador, excellent.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll deal with this reform of the UN. I'm pardoning my voice. The reform of the UN has been on the cards in New York for more than 15 years. It reached a climax in 2005 where all the leaders, galvanized by the former Secretary General Kofi Annan, committed. Now the reform takes shape in three areas. How the UN is managed, that is the Secretariat, the reform of the General Assembly, which is the highest policy making body of the UN, and the reform of the Security Council. Of course, I think some advance was made, especially on the issue of management of the UN. A lot of things have been changed and a lot of progress has been made. The two big problems, the General Assembly and the Security Council. And it's not because of political sensitivities. It divides, the UN is always divided between North and South. But this time around, especially on the Security Council, even the South is not united. Even at the AU, there's a group that does not want, does not adhere to a UN consensus, as we called it then. But what's happening now was that, because of the sensitivity, the President of the General Assembly, who is now driving the reform process, decided to take it out of the General Assembly, asked a few ambassadors to drive this process in some working groups, try and see whether they can close the misunderstanding. If there is some general understanding among member states, then it can be brought back to the General Assembly rather than keep it there and then there's no progress in terms of negotiations. That's what's happening now. The big thing in the Security Council is we're not sure, we're almost sure that some members of the FIFA, the permanent five, some of them will never want to give away the veto. We're not sure whether others may, but there are those that are very clear that they will not want to give away their veto. And then there's also the issue of the veto within the African member states. There are those who say you should not push too much for the veto. We in South Africa were saying if and when we become permanent members, because that's a stated goal of the federal government, we should not be second-class citizens in the Security Council. If those have a veto, we should also enjoy the veto. But I can easily say it's stuck now. It's stuck outside the framework of the General Assembly. So it's in the small working groups, and very little progress is made, except in the management of the UN. And in the management of the UN, it's caused a lot of progress because it involves money. So your US and your Japan, who are the biggest contributors, make sure that their money, the management of the UN is done in a transparent way according to all the rules. It's what they call the controller. That's their auditor general. We call them the controllers. Controllers are very strict check. So that's why we score games there, because as I say, the asset contributions from member states, the biggest is Japan and the US. So that's where we are now, and presently the economic crisis has taken center stage, so all the other issues are playing second fiddle in terms of activities around the multilateral system. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. With regard to the rapid response team, Daisy mentioned in his presentation that amongst our duties are citizens abroad, and in the event of emergencies or crisis situations happening, we have to render support to the families and so forth in South Africa as well. Now, members would note that the missions, we have limited capacity to deal with that in missions. We have capacity in missions to deal basically with our consular services like prison visits and so forth. But in the event of a tsunami or a major earthquake where there's many citizens, South African citizens involved, and we have to render that kind of assistance, we don't have the capacity of the missions to do that. So the department has trained a number of people from various different groupings within the department and admissions abroad to come together at a moment's notice when there's an emergency so that we can respond to those situations, to basically deal with the situation, contact families, family members in South Africa, also coordinate and and extend the support to those South Africans that are interested in support. So that's basically the role of the Rapid Response Team. It's combined what is called the Coordinated Emergency Response Center from South Africa, where we would put together a 24-hour call center or 24-hour emergency response center to basically deal with those emergency situations at hand. Thank you.
Chair, sorry, just a quick comment. But then it links up to what a member said earlier, that such rapid response teams would only be effective if ROSA is effective.
Colleagues, we're moving towards the end of this session. I want us to raise the following. Once a teacher, always a teacher, DG. Not only the nurses, the World Teachers Congress, which is the biggest global union federation with more than 30 million educators. That's what I've been the president of, by the way. Is conferencing in South Africa in 2011, July 2011. We've already signed agreement with ICC. And we normally draw in the UNESCO DG, ILO, and so on. But we normally deal with the Department of Education on those issues. Of course, we will come to you. So there's a lot of interest in South Africa indeed. So I think that's a very important event to be known. Colleagues, I know that most of us would have wanted more time to engage with the strike plan given by the DG or by the department. But given the program of Parliament, we're ready to hit the ground running. We have very little time. Next week, that Thursday, the 18th, if I'm right, the minister will be presenting her budget vote to the House. And as the committee now, we have a fair understanding of the direction of the department and the ministry. And we understand the principles which are informing that particular program. And then we will be able to engage. I know that a meeting is still coming of the committee next week. But it's likely in terms of our plans just to be a day before, because you know we have Monday constituency work and we have Tuesday, which is June 16th. We're very passionate about defending June 16th. So we'll be on the ground talking to the masses. So we will come back and talk about how we want to handle that session as the committee. But let me take this opportunity and thank the Honorable Deputy Ministers, of course the Minister in absentia and the DG. We will certainly, as this portfolio committee, come back to both the ministry and the department on a number of issues. We need to still develop, most of us are new, a common understanding of this oversight role of this particular committee. Once we have adopted our own program as a committee, we would want to go into some workshop mode later on, so that we have a very clear understanding. I've just been alerted to some department operating here called International Relations in Parliament, so that we understand its role, we understand the role of the ministry and the department, we understand our role as the committee, we avoid cross lines. But we will come back with the proposals to you in relation to those issues. Because we must never, ever, ever think that we are the department or we are the diplomats. But we must be able to say we need to understand the issues. And some of the issues, when you deal with these people with rough issues of diplomatic language and are very important. So we'll come back with all those issues. But for now, thank you very much for presenting this to us. There's still further engagement. So we will step off this particular item and move to an item which I said I hate most, any other business. If the members say there's none, then let me declare that we would adjourn. We'll come to the end of this particular first business committee meeting. And thank you very much, members, for your participation. And you can see Deputy Ministers and DGA together with the staff members supporting the department that we're raising the issues from our common knowledge perspective, not from the expert point of view. So further engagement is going to be necessary on those issues, but we will not be afraid of raising issues. We are still going to establish some ground rules. I know that one of the issues we've said when we interact with the department, we are going to be interacting with the ministry through the minister and the deputy minister, and with the department through the DG. If we have made a request to the department and then we have sent a very junior official, we will reject that junior official. But if the DG is here, we have a particular area we are interested in, then have to bring some other junior officials who are experts in that particular field. We won't object to that. So there will be certain issues which will be very tough on as we continue. But of course, in the process, we will find one another. Let me take this opportunity to thank everybody who has shown interest into this particular committee today. Hard, complex, international relations issues. Thank you very much. The meeting is going to end.